want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to Keita Tom of Corvallis, Oregon, and also to Patricia Dahlhoff of Crescent City, California. They're underwriting this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. You can help, too. Just log on to peterbcollins.com. On this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show, we'll check in on ongoing investigations of corruption in Washington, D.C., where one thing does lead to another. Melanie Sloan from Crew will join us in just a moment. And then from Washington, D.C., we're going to take a little trip to Washington, California. That's in the Sierra Nevada near Lake Tahoe, where you'll be surprised to learn that the number one cash crop is smokable. And also on today's show, Professor Larry Bogad from the University of California at Davis. He is a specialist in the theater of politics. And he and that wacky group called the Yes Men are claiming responsibility for the phony issue of the New York Post that hit the streets this past Monday with the headline, "We're Screwed." And he'll tell the story that one of his associates believes he actually got a copy of the phony New York Post right into the hands of Rupert Murdoch. That's all ahead here on the Peter B. Collins Show today. And we welcome back Melanie Sloan. She is the Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Shorthand is CREW, and they're on the web at citizensforethics.org. And Melanie was a regular contributor, almost a weekly visitor to the Peter B. Collins syndicated radio program. And it's great to be back in touch, Melanie. How are you today?
Excellent, Peter. It's so nice to be with you again.
Before we dive into some specific cases and your newest release, the listing of the 15 most corrupt elected officials in Washington, I wanted to get your view of the overall sea change. Because a year ago, as we were talking elections and campaigns, I was certainly pleased to see the tide turning against Republicans. Those are my political biases. But I raised the alarm then, and I raise it again today, about the excesses of one-party rule. And we saw it when the Republicans were in control and rammed bills through, and we had corruption of people like Tom DeLay and the Abramoff scandal and many others. And some of those individuals went to jail. Some are still waiting for their turn. But we go back a few years to when the Democrats were in control. Jim Wright was the speaker. He had his own scandal over a book deal. And so fundamentally, I'm always worried, concerned, that when one party has excessive control in Washington, that ethics go out the window and enforcement of the basic rules of conduct often simply goes unaddressed.
And that's a very reasonable fear and concern to have, Peter. And I would say it turns out that nothing's really changed in Washington that way. One thing we have seen is corruption is on the upswing. And I think that this was predictable. As CREW has always said, you have to have power to abuse it. The Democrats didn't have any before, so you had fewer Democrats who were engaged in corrupt behavior. Now that there's more power, you're seeing greater and greater problems among the Democrats, not that they're the sole violators by any stretch of the imagination, mm-hmm. but they definitely have some problems.
Yeah. Well, and let's start off with Mike Ross. He's a Blue Dog Democrat who is pivotal in the health care debate right now. In fact, I believe the Democrats have given him too much leverage in their deliberations in their own caucus. But it appears that he took a page out of the Duke Cunningham playbook, and he sold his house and, he sold his pharmacy and got a sweetheart deal for his wife. And he sold it to a company that has made campaign contributions to him and stands to benefit from health care reform.
Right. If the facts are as they're purported to be right now, this is a congressman who's likely going to be seeing jail time in the not-too-distant future. There's going to have to be some very good facts on his side that we don't know about right now to get him out of this. But what Mike Ross did is, back in 2007, he and his wife owned a pharmacy, and they sold it to a huge company that has many drug stores, and they sold it for well over the price of the value of the property. Mm-hmm. The generous way you can look at it is it was at least $143,000 more than the property was worth. And then they sold the assets of the business for between $500,000 and $1 million. And then, in addition, his wife got a contract not to compete with this pharmacy, for which she was paid at least $100,000, perhaps up to $250,000. So the Rosses took in a fortune from this company, USA Drug, and its chief executive officer or owner, a guy named Stephen LaFrance, who 2 weeks after this deal went down made a $2,300 contribution to Mr. Ross. And this looks just terrible. I mean, this is exactly reminiscent of Duke Cunningham. The Department of Justice is generally hesitant to go after members who trade campaign contributions for legislative assistance. But if you're going to take money into your personal pocketbook, a la Duke Cunningham, who sold his house for way more than its value to a defense contractor, mm-hmm. for whom he was doing favors, if Mike Ross is engaged in that kind of activity, he's going to find himself indicted.
And Rachel Maddow had an interesting tidbit about this on her report on television, which is that when this transfer of the property that includes the pharmacy was posted, that the people at the real estate office or the tax assessor, I'm not quite sure who it was, were shocked by the inflated price, and they actually made a phone call and said, "Is this right?"
Right. It was sometime after the sale went through. Nevada County, the county in which Prescott, Arkansas, is located, they have a contractor that does 5-year assessments for them, checking out property costs, and they did, in fact, call USA Drug, the company that bought it, to make sure that the price was right, because it seemed incongruous with the area.
Yeah, that is amazing. Well, stay on this one because, I've gotten beyond, picking winners and losers based on party. We really need to root out corruption, and I don't care where it exists.
Right.
And now let's step into the the very special class of the 15 most corrupt members of Congress. And I want to start with Charlie Rangel because, again, he's a powerful Democratic leader. His misdeeds have been, I think, very well chronicled. And we now have him restating his income from last year to catch up with almost $500,000 that he just forgot to report on his disclosure forms. Now, if Ted Stevens got bounced out of the Senate for his failure to report the gifts that he got, how is Charles Rangel any different for what appears to be intentional failure to report significant income?
Well, the only difference that I can see so far is that it looks like Charlie Rangel was really sloppy on his form. Some years he got things right, and some years he didn't. And that's a little bit different than Ted Stevens' pattern of year after year leaving out the exact same things. Because Mr. Rangel put it on sometimes and didn't put it on sometimes, there's the question of whether he had the intent to hide it. And that's one of the things that's very difficult to prosecute in these cases. You have to have deliberately failed to include this. And for a prosecutor to prove that could be tough. Not to say that this isn't terrible for Rangel, and it's impossible to understand how a man in his financial position can't keep track of a checking account that has at least $250,000 in it. I mean, he's not Bill Gates. He doesn't have that kind of money. You'd think a checking account with $250,000 on it would be something he'd remember.
Yeah.
And this is by far from his only problem, and also, let me say, not even his most serious problem. The most serious ethics problem Charlie Rangel has is that it appears that he traded legislation, a tax break for a company called Neighbors Industries, a loophole that will allow them to keep millions of dollars in return for a $1 million contribution to the Rengel Center at the City College of New York from the company's chairman. Yeah. That's the kind of thing that I think could get Rengel a criminal investigation.
And where does it stand right now? We last spoke in March, and during the preceding year, Melanie Sloan, the House had made some minor modifications to the ethics process. And the way I described it was they opened a new window where you could drop off ethics complaints that would be ignored, just like the ones you dropped off at the main entrance to the Ethics Committee office. But are we seeing any attention to these critical and rather eyebrow-raising issues?
It's very hard to say. The Office of Congressional Ethics, which is what you're talking about, can only take complaints for activities that occurred post-March of 2008 when they suddenly have jurisdiction. The House Ethics Committee has been looking at Rengel for well over a year now, and that was instigated by Mr. Rengel himself, since no other member would have filed a complaint against him and outside groups aren't allowed to file there. But, of course, the Ethics Committee has just sat on the Rengel matter for a year, and it's my guess that even when they eventually do come out and say anything, they'll just use it as a teaching moment and remind members about what the rules are.
Mm-hmm. Now let's jump over to Senator John Ensign of Nevada. And this has a sex scandal attached to it, but that's not what Crew is interested in. You're not salacious or prurient over there. One of the issues is the way he paid off the woman who was his mistress. She was a former Senate staffer. He got her a job at the campaign committee. He got her son a job there. And then his parents, and this is a remarkable development. I don't know anybody whose parents would bail out their child over a mistress issue. But his parents paid her nearly $100,000. Now, this is a substantive set of issues related to where that money came from, if it was misuse of either staff funds or campaign funds. And it appears that, you know, this is a case like David Vitter or any of the others that's just going to go away because the media has gotten tired of it.
Right, and there is a potential serious problem here. Luckily, we don't have to rely on the Senate Ethics Committee. The Federal Election Commission is also looking at this because we filed a complaint there. But the real the nub of the issue for Mr. Ensign is because he if Cynthia Hampton, the woman who he was having an affair with, was fired and then was given some kind of severance payment, any kind of payment made to her as severance would have been basically paid in, somebody would have been standing in lieu of the campaign committee to make that payment. And that would constitute an in-kind contribution to the campaign committee. Well, there are no reports of any in-kind contributions to the campaign committee. So that means the $96,000 paid to Cynthia Hampton was never reported as a contribution, which is required under federal law. A failure to report contributions totaling $25,000 in one calendar year is a criminal violation, a felony punishable by up to 5 years in jail. So whether it's the Ensigns who made the contribution or John Ensign himself who paid it off, that failure to report is a felony.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in the Senate, we have a short timer. This is Roland Burris, who succeeded Barack Obama as the junior senator from Illinois. We know about the Blagojevich pay-for-play scandal, but what are the issues now surrounding Senator Burris and the way that he tried to defend himself against charges that he had tried to make a deal with Blagojevich, his brother, and other associates?
Well, there are real questions about whether he committed perjury. Mr. Burris has told many a different story about how he got the Senate seat and what he had offered or not offered to Mr. Blagojevich in return for it. I mean, it was such a spectacle when it first happened, and as you'll probably remember, and as many of your listeners will, Mr. Burris went to see many senators, including Senator Reid, and he swore up and down that he had not had any kind of conversations with Blagojevich about money, and that turns out not to be true. So at the very least, a Senate Ethics Committee investigation into whether he lied is currently pending. Whether the Ethics Committee will ever finish that, given that Mr. Burris has now said he's not going to run again, probably they'll just drop it. But, you know, anytime there's an Ethics Committee investigation, we include the person on our list. The same matter brings in Jesse Jackson Jr., mm-hmm. member in the House, who also was found in the Blagojevich criminal information to have been potentially offering money in return, campaign contributions in return for being appointed to the seat. Mr. Jackson is under federal investigation as well as investigation by the Office of Congressional Ethics.
And it's interesting because Burris gets whatever media attention there is about these issues, And the issues with Jackson Jr., again, appear to be off the media's radar screen.
They do. I think that that'll certainly turn around if somebody finds that Jackson did something wrong, and I think mostly they're probably waiting to see what U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald comes out with about Jackson. Mm-hmm. Jackson says he's cooperating with the investigation. I think people feel sorry for him and that he's just been caught up in something that isn't necessarily illegal, but I think that remains to be seen. And again, it's never a good sign when you're named in somebody's criminal information offering to pay up good money for a Senate seat.
Now, there are a couple other Democrats who unfortunately deserve this attention, and John Murtha, the John of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, as he likes to claim, is a guy who is deep in pork, deep in conflicts of interest, and he's one of the top recipients of campaign cash from military contractors and those who service the Pentagon. He's one of the leading recipients of money specifically related to the phony Star Wars missile defense system that the Obama administration has canceled from the Czech Republic and Poland, which I'm gratified to see. But Murtha continues to do business the old way, even with the spotlight that you and others have placed on his ethics activities.
Right, and let me just also say here, one good way to keep track of everything John Murtha is up to is Crew created a new website since you and I last talked called youdontknowjack.org, and that will keep track of all of the permutations of this interesting and important story. But Mr. Murtha, this is one of the places where you really have to criticize the Democratic leadership for leaving Mr. Murtha in this position of power, given that more and more comes out all the time, but it does seem like the walls are closing in on Murtha. There is an ongoing criminal investigation into his ties with a former lobbying group that's now shut down called the PMA Group, and whether there were trades of campaign contributions for earmarks with that group's clients.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that he is still earmarking money to groups that he has conflicts of interest with that have been exposed.
Shamelessly. And in fact, I think the thing that may cause him the most trouble is he has insisted that several different contractors hire his nephew, Robert Murtha, who has then done absolutely no work. And he has made sure that if they hired Robert Murtha, they got contracts and they produced very little for that money. And that's the kind of thing that justice really does look at.
Before we move on to other active members of Congress, I have to get your reaction to Tom DeLay's appearance on Dancing with the Stars. I don't watch that show, but the excerpts have been splashed all over programs I do watch. And not only does it bring up my gag reflex, but it reminds us all that this guy rigged the districting in Texas while he was the majority leader of the House. And there are many other questionable and probably illegal deeds that he's responsible for. And yet he's gotten off scot-free and is able to dance on television.
Right. I too find it disappointing. I have never watched Dancing with the Stars before, but I did Monday night, and in fact, Crew hosted a watch party because we thought plenty of our friends would be interested in watching such a huge fall from such a esteemed position of power to such an undignified place. And certainly, you couldn't use the word dignity in conjunction with Mr. DeLay's appearance. Dancing and doing the air guitar to Wild Thing was not what you would expect from a former majority leader. It was an embarrassing performance, and since he's not going to go to jail, I think at least he can be embarrassed on a television reality show.
Well, they should have had a hot tub there just for reality effect. Now, one of the members of your 15 most corrupt who pains me is Maxine Waters.
I knew we were going to talk about her.
Well, it's important for me to be honest with my listeners because I do talk to Maxine from time to time, and I have raised this issue with her. She doesn't want to talk about it, clearly. But it really bothers me because Maxine is one of the true progressives who I turn to on many issues. She's one of the few people who has admitted to me that she regrets a vote, and that was specifically on the Homegrown Terrorism Act that was jammed through the House about a year and a half ago. But that doesn't excuse that she sought special favors for her husband and the One United Bank. Tell us the details of this.
Yeah, this is a story that is very troubling, and I am happy to report that it is under investigation by the Office of Congressional Ethics, although, again, since we've never seen anything good come out of an ethics committee investigation or the Office of Congressional Ethics, I don't necessarily have high hopes, but at least they've recognized it is a problem. Maxine Waters pushed Treasury officials to have a meeting with One United Bank And pushed them also to give the bank bailout funds that they probably otherwise wouldn't have gotten, and they got millions of dollars in these bailout funds. And at the same time, Ms. Waters neglected to mention to Treasury officials that she had any kind of conflict, that her husband had a financial interest in the bank, that he was on the board of directors. Treasury officials were very upset to discover that later. This is exactly the kind of thing that members are prohibited from doing. They are not allowed to use their positions to improve their own personal financial interests, and yet that's exactly what she did. And this bank has some real problems. For example, although it's supposed to be terrific for minorities, it has financed very few minority mortgages. And the president of the bank was using all sorts of money to live very high on the hog, I think with a great house in Malibu.
Oh, wow. That's a little distance from South Central, which is, I think, where the bank is supposed to be focused.
Yeah.
Well, keep working on that because, again, I don't believe in protecting people, even if their politics agree with mine. Now, let's talk about some of the Republicans who've been around the track a few times. Jerry Lewis of California. How does he remain unindicted?
You know, I don't know how he remains unindicted. The same way Alan Mollahan remains unindicted and John Murtha remains unindicted. I just don't know what the Justice Department is doing in these cases. Mr. Lewis has been under investigation for several years now over his connections to a lobbyist named Bill Lowry, who, interestingly enough, had been a congressman himself, and he lost his seat to Duke Cunningham on an ethics matter. But Bill Lowry and his clients were responsible for over a third of Jerry Lewis's campaign contributions, and in return, it was well known that if you wanted an earmark from Jerry Lewis, you went to Bill Lowry. And that's just one of the many ways Mr. Lewis has used his position to financially benefit friends and family. Very troubling, and I'd like to see him indicted one of these days.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Vern Buchanan in Florida? I know about him because there were a lot of questions about the elections that he allegedly won.
Vern Buchanan is another member who I wouldn't be surprised at all to see indicted one of these days. He did something that justice officials do tend to take seriously, which is he does own a bunch of car dealerships, and Mr. Buchanan required people who worked for him to make contributions to his campaign, and in return, those people were reimbursed either by Mr. Buchanan personally or by the car dealerships. That is a very big no-no. Criminal penalties apply. If Mr. Buchanan is caught in that, we can expect him to be indicted. Crew had filed a complaint with the FEC over a year ago, and, you know, they're looking at it.
All right. Now, I think this is a new name for me anyway, Nathan Deal, a Republican from Georgia. What's his story, Melanie?
This is another troubling member who's abusing his position for his own financial purposes. Mr. Deal owns a business down in Georgia where he runs inspection stations where the state can come in and inspect vehicles that want to get titles after they've been junk cars when they're being revamped. And the Georgia Commissioner of Revenue, also a Republican, decided that this wasn't a very good system, and he wanted to get rid of the system and change it. Mr. Deal used his position to arrange with the Lieutenant Governor of Georgia to force the Revenue Commissioner to come in for several meetings where he was handed his head, told that he shouldn't be changing this. Mr. Deal also used his chief of staff to send emails to Georgia State Senate staffers and senators to make sure that this program didn't go through. So basically, Mr. Deal used his position to ensure that he could keep his own car, his state inspection business that brings him in $150,000 a year. And he's, by the way, running for governor of Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Got time for one more. Mitch McConnell is the Republican leader in the Senate, and he is a five-termer from Kentucky. What are his issues?
Mr. McConnell, like Mr. Murtha and others, has long used his position to financially benefit friends and family. A former top staffer of his, a guy named Gordon Bates, has set up a lobbying firm, and you go to Gordon Bates and you can get your earmark from Mitch McConnell, and in return, Mr. McConnell has gotten great contributions from Mr. Bates' clients.
Mm-hmm. And is this known in Kentucky? Has it been an issue? He was reelected last year.
It was an issue in Kentucky, and it was an issue in his last election, but, you know, it's a very conservative state.
Yeah. So the other members that we didn't get to talk about in detail include Ken Calvert of California, Don Young of Alaska, and Laura Richardson of California. You can read all about it. You can go to Crew's website, their main website, citizenforethics.com. Citizens, sorry, there's an S there. Citizensforethics.com.
.org,
sorry. And then the most corrupt members of Congress are on a separate site, CruzMostCorrupt.org. That's Cruz, no apostrophe in there, cruzmostcorrupt.org. Melanie Sloan, always a pleasure. Thanks for the work that you're doing in Washington.
Oh, my pleasure, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Moving now from the corruption in Washington, D.C., to the placid, sun-baked Washington,
marijuana.
California.
Perfect plant.
Our music of the moment coming from the Cottonmouth Kings, the only musical group I know that combines the worship of marijuana with rock and roll and a rap mentality. It's pretty special. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic and maybe you smoke it too, it's time to drink organic. Try the earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. You get a special introductory offer. That's from the Cottonmouth Kings release back in 02 called Rollin' Stoned. And that's the final song called Light It Up. And apparently Gideon Lewis Krause took a lighter with him because in order to prove that he was not a narc when he went to Nevada County in the tiny town of Washington, he confesses in the article that he occasionally inhaled. Gideon, welcome to our program.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you for supporting California's number one cash crop. So what drew you to the tiny town of Washington, California? I've never been there. I've been to Nevada County. I've been to Nevada City and some of the better known areas. That's east of Sacramento and before you get to Lake Tahoe on Interstate 80. But now I'm going to have to drop by the post office because I want to meet Buck.
Well, he's there every day.
Yeah.
You'll meet him, yeah. I'm still in touch with him and still up in Washington and still at the post office. He lives in town now, which he didn't when I was there.
Mm-hmm. And so what intrigued you about this?
Well, actually, I didn't really know anything about the whole pot situation there. But I had a couple of friends. I was living in San Francisco at the time who were from Nevada County, and they always used to talk about a party that Buck threw every summer on a lake up on BLM land, where he would get people to build houseboats, and they would have a big houseboat party. And so they would always talk about this character, Buck, and how he had this ridiculous job in a post office where he sat there and did 20 minutes of work all day and then did God knows what at mm-hmm. this town in the middle of nowhere. So originally I envisioned the piece as being a piece just sort of about what it's like to have this clerical job and what his days must be like, sort of a piece about boredom in the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Well, the party on the lake kind of sounds like Burning Man without all the sand.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's, I think that's not too far off. So I went up just to hang out with Buck, and then once I got up there, I wasn't there for, I was there for maybe 2 hours before people started showing me their growing trailers and the pitches behind their houses where they had their crops. And all of a sudden I realized this entire town basically functions on an informal pot economy.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, the original idea of the piece, which was just to be based around Buck and his sort of weird relationship to this town, it was just, my idea was that it was going to be sort of straight portraiture. I went to Harper's with it, and they said, and I sort of explained the whole thing, and they said, well, you know, that sounds like an interesting place, and it sounds like a weird story, and your pitch was interesting, but I think we need something with a little bit more of a hook to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sort of talked about possible hooks, and then I was about to hang up with my editor, and I said, oh, and I guess there's one more thing I didn't mention. Basically, this town functions on pot. And he said, why didn't you say anything? Let's do that. So then the piece ended up being built a bit more around the pot culture in town.
Now let's talk about the editors at Harper's. Who are the potheads there? Because it was only a year ago that they commissioned a great story about Humboldt County. So who are the
Oh wait, no, that was a New Yorker story.
Oh, you're right about that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I get my magazines mixed up. Okay. So this is the first pot story in Harper's in a while, I guess.
I think so, yeah. I can't think of one recently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I withdraw that then.
Although it is funny. So as someone else just pointed out to me, it's a weird month for pot stories. I think that there's a pot story on the cover of Fortune this month. There was a pot story in the Times the other day.
Well, you know, the pressure is building, and part of it is the economy here in California on its knees because our steroid-driven governor just, no new taxes, we just gut the state, you know?
Yeah.
And Tom Amiano is a courageous gay assembly member from San Francisco who has still no co-sponsors on his bill to legalize marijuana. But it's really starting to get a second look because... Number one, people have accepted that under Proposition 215, that medical marijuana is here to stay,
right,
and that it has created this whole black zone between state and federal law, and that's got to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And then you just look at the numbers. Amiano's conservative projections are that legalized pot with a tax of $50 an ounce would generate about $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
Now, that's more than the offshore oil drilling that Arnold's been talking about.
Yeah.
It's more than any of that waste, fraud, and abuse that you can shake out of the system. And it is a new source of revenue, and the state desperately needs that.
Yeah.
So I don't expect things to change immediately, but I think we are on a track where in 5 or 10 years, we'll come up with some compromise that lets the tough-on-crime people stay tough on crime and allows a reasonable way for people to possess and use cannabis without the threat of law enforcement.
Well, unfortunately, as far as the subjects of my story go, I think that the way that's going to be, that will be resolved when the big pharmaceutical companies figure out a way to do this on a large scale. And once they can imagine how doing this in a profitable way, and once they manage to convince the politicians of that, that's when we're going to see the widespread legalization, and that's also when all the guys that I wrote about in Washington are going to be pretty much out of business.
Well, that's an interesting point, because we have what is a barely underground economy, as you describe in your letter from California in Harper's. And, you know, we certainly enjoy the benefits of it. If you go to Humboldt or Mendocino County and go to the car dealers and say, well, did you sell any pickups this week? Anybody take out a loan? Well, no, they always pay cash.
Yeah.
And so these economies, one of your subjects points out that in the area, say, within 100 miles of Washington, California, there's about $2 million spent on various accessories used,
yeah,
to grow pot.
Yep.
So,
as you said, you know, those are all mom-and-pop hardware stores.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't imagine that our legislators will say, well, you know, we've got to find a way. I'm thinking now about health care reform, that they're so intent on making sure that the for-profit insurance companies can stay in the game.
Yeah.
I don't imagine that they're going to say, well, you know, we've got to keep these mom-and-pop growers in the game. So, yeah, it'll get corporatized, and that certainly would change things a lot. And do you sense that in Washington, California, anybody worries ever about getting busted?
No, I don't think so. I mean, certainly no one talked about it. There was, as I wrote about in the piece, there's this sort of vague idea of menace, but I think it's more because they want to feel like they're being checked up on a little bit than really actually in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly no sign of law enforcement in town, and nobody really had any stories. I mean, people had stories about being busted 10, 20 years ago. One of the guys, Bob, that I wrote about had done a brief stint in prison at some point for a very small possession charge.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't be happier that now he no longer, you know, feels that threat hanging over him.
And to some extent, some of these people do experience a kind of self-induced paranoia when they smoke certain types of very powerful pot.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is interesting because, you know, if you live outside the law, you're always looking over your shoulder. You're always prepared, I guess, for law enforcement to arrive and deal with you. And then to induce that feeling for escape or pleasure, that's kind of interesting and counterintuitive, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So did you smoke some good shit up there? You know, I read in your piece that you shared a few joints with people, and I guess you tasted some green dragon and some purple something or other. Did you think the quality was pretty good?
The quality was mixed. You know, I have to say I'm not a particularly big smoker. So I was not quite prepared for what it was going to be like to report the piece. And you know, the stuff that one of the guys is growing underneath his black trash bags did not seem to me to be particularly, you know, I'm as I said, not much of a connoisseur, but did not seem to me to be particularly good. But then some of the stuff the younger people had seemed to be more involved in elaborate cross-straining mechanics and stuff like that. So, yes, then there was some better pot. But after a while, it was hard to tell the difference anymore since everyone is basically just high all the time.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about Tie-Dye Bob, who hangs out at the post office, but Buck doesn't allow him to smoke on the premises.
No, not allowed to smoke in the post office.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, Bob's a wonderful guy and really cares about Buck. They have this incredibly nice relationship. They spend hours a day together, even though they couldn't possibly be more different. But when Bob wants to smoke his joints, Buck makes him stand outside. Buck's pretty careful to observe the post office protocol.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, he seems like a really good postmaster.
He's a very, very good postmaster.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that that struck me is you described Tie-Dye Bob. You say he was living down in Marysville or maybe Smartville when he decided to head to Nashville. And one of the things that I noticed in Mendocino and Humboldt counties is that the place names are really boring.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of this town and Thatville, and you got the idea that even before they were growing pot there, people seemed a little impaired, and their imagination seemed a little limited.
Possible.
But I guess part of it is that California is just so big that they ran out of place names that are clever and have a Spanish influence.
Someone was actually just showing me a reissue of a book, I forget what the title is, by George R. Stewart, who was best known for a few science fiction novels he wrote in the 50s. One was called Earth Abides, that I believe Stephen King later based The Stand on. And he wrote this almanac about the history of place names in America that New York Review Classics just reissued that looked great. I wonder if there's stuff in there about these California cities.
Mm-hmm. McKinleyville, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, yeah.
You just got the idea that they were lazy when they were thinking those up. So what are the economics of this, Gideon? What do you see? Are these people subsisting? Are they making a good living? Do they mostly smoke their own crop, or do they sell it to the dispensaries where they legally can, you know, grow weed and then sell it to these cannabis clubs that are able to dispense it under the law here in California?
Well, the deepest I got into the economics was talking to the one guy named Art, who had a really thorough setup and was making an attempt to do it as in a commercially viable way. And I run through the numbers in the piece, and my memory is that he was clearing something like 10 grand a fiscal quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing pretty well, but he was doing an enormous amount of work for $40,000 a year. I mean, he was working much harder than practically anybody I knew at the time in San Francisco. So he was getting by. He was making a nice living. It's obviously not expensive to live up in Washington, but he was certainly never flush. Some of the older people, I got the impression that they were mostly just growing for themselves, and occasionally, if they had stuff left over, they would sell it to the clubs down in San Francisco.
And do these people have a sense that this is that they're coasting into their sunset years and that they don't want to, you know, live in a big city and stress with a regular job. Are they kind of committed counterculture people?
Well, the impression that I got was that their flight from the city was a gradual thing, that a lot of the older people had been in San Francisco in the mid to late 60s, and then one guy told me the hate started to get pretty scary by 70 or 71 when the speed had moved in, and he started to get freaked out, and he thought he had to leave San Francisco, and back then Marin was still pretty cheap. So he told me, and I think he was a representative guy, that first he moved up to Marin where he lived cheaply, then Marin started to get built up, and then he was in Vacaville for a couple of years, and then he was in Auburn for a couple of years, and then he was in Nevada City for a couple of years. So he just was slowly chased up into the mountains. And one of the things that appealed to me about Washington is that it's the end of the road. You can't go any further. So these guys, and it's at the bottom of this ravine. It's at the end of a dead end road. So this was where, you know, all of these currents of drift left these people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, a couple of decades after having left San Francisco.
Now, toward the end of your piece, you tell a story, and I'll simplify it for people. But you say that Buck, the guy from the post office, has an idea for a local kid named Donnie who can basically get paid to help take care of Tie-Dye Bob.
Right.
And Tie-Dye Bob is eligible for disability. And so Buck calls people at the county, and basically he puts together this deal where Donnie can get paid $8.15 an hour to probably sit around and roll joints for Bob.
It seemed like when they were talking about this that there was, you know, it wasn't going to be nothing. It was going to be helping the guy do his groceries and cleaning up his trailer a bit. You know, it wasn't going to be absolutely no work at all, but it was certainly wasn't like Bob, you know, needed somebody to hold his hand to get by.
Mm-hmm. And so what you raise here is a kind of sensitivity where they have great hostility for the federal government.
Right.
But unlike some of these town hall mobsters that we've seen surface this summer,
yeah,
spouting corporate talking points, they don't have that same hostility for their local government, and they feel that it's okay to interact with them and accept services or reimbursement from them, but the federal government is more the enemy.
Yeah. I mean, they have a sense for what the local government does for them. I mean, they see the truck from the food bank come through. So they understand that what they're getting from the county government is, you know, is something pretty tangible and doesn't seem distant and doesn't seem foreign in the way that the federal government, they can only imagine as this this awful, oppressive overlord, even though they have virtually nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And does anybody pick up on the irony that the legislation, what's called the trailer bill, that was supposed to clean up some of the fuzzy areas of Prop 215 was Senate Bill 420?
Yeah. I hadn't heard that.
It's true.
That's hilarious. Someone had an amusing sense of humor somewhere.
Well, I think there's somebody in Sacramento who just isn't hip enough to understand what those numbers mean.
Or is very hip, actually.
That could be, yeah. Well, Gideon, thank you for a delightful piece. It's great to talk to you. Gideon Lewis Krause, and this is called A Letter from California, entitled Tocqueville on the Frontiers of Federalism and Dope, and it is in your current issue, that is the October issue of Harper's Magazine that's out there now.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here, Gideon. Take care.
Bye.
It's time for more on the Peter B. Collins Show. I think what we need is a little more political theater. I mean, those right-wing corporate-fed mobsters who broke up the town hall meetings, that's one flavor. But we need to go out and make some of our own.
And if your dreams on time, you can get to work by nine and start your
Returning to our program today is Larry Bogad. That's Lawrence Michael Bogad. Find his website, lmbogad.com. Larry is associate professor at the University of California, Davis. He's authored a number of books, including Electoral Guerrilla Theater, Radical Ridicule and Social Movements. He's been on the move recently. He was in New York to welcome the leaders of nations to the UN's annual General Assembly, and we're going to talk about that. He currently checks in from Pittsburgh, where he is monitoring the events at the G20 Economic Summit. Larry, welcome. How are you today?
Thanks so much, Peter. I'm doing great.
There is so much to talk about because you have been very busy. Let me first explore and dodge the question to the extent your lawyers would advise you.
Fair enough.
But what is your connection to the Yes Men?
Oh, the Yes Men are these great guys known as Andy and Mike. They are wonderful pranksters. They do this great thing they call identity correction, where some people call it identity fraud because they pretend to represent ExxonMobil in various embarrassing ways or Dow Chemical.
Yeah,
they
Dow.
They call it identity correction because they're saying what these folks should really be saying if they were more honest.
Yeah, the Dow, recently they posed as spokespersons for Dow Chemical, and on behalf of Dow, they accepted responsibility for the Bhopal disaster, which, of course, was Union Carbide's problem, but Dow bought Union Carbide,
absolutely,
much as Chevron inherited the mess in Ecuador when it took over Texaco.
Absolutely.
And these corporate entities want to pretend that, well, that's not my problem. I mean, I just bought a pig and a poke. You're not going to hold me responsible.
We'll take the profits, but the liabilities, not so sure about that, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with the Yes Men, they will work with other artists or writers or performers on various projects, and they've been very gracious to bring me in on a couple recently, which I'm happy about because it's great to work with those guys.
And all this information is at the Peter B. Collins Show file on this podcast, which is number 39, and there's a link there to the Yes Men website, which is theyesmen.org. That's theyesmen.org. And I invite you to go there and see some of their antics, because these are not just casual pranks, Larry. These are pretty well-resourced and well-researched efforts.
These are really quality pranks. We're going for quality.
Yeah, because you're going beyond just, you know, getting a little attention and a little TV FaceTime for a street protest. You're really going deeper and trying to really show what corporate responsibility would look like if anybody bothered to embrace it.
That's it. It's sort of one of the attempts, you know, what we do very often in social movements, which is understandable, is we protest against what we don't want, and of course that makes sense. But it's also kind of important to show, well, what's the world you do want? What would your victory, what would your winning look like? You know what I mean? What's the world you want to see? And that's sort of what the fake New York Times prank that the Yes Men and Steve Lambert and many other artists, including myself, worked on. It was the New York Times that came out last November that if you looked at the fine print in that little box, it didn't say all the news that's fit to print. It said all the news we hope to print,
mm-hmm,
you know, and it sort of had all the good news we would like to see in the world.
And you welcomed the United Nations this week, and climate change, yeah, is a very significant topic, with a mocked-up version of the New York Post. Now, this is, I think, a fabulous stunt because I can imagine somebody riding the subway in New York, and they've got half an hour to peruse this spoof newspaper. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of content in here. There's a lot of real information and a lot of points of view that probably never quite make it into Murdoch's tabloid.
That's correct. We basically, the concept of it was, we'd like to help Rupert Murdoch out. I mean, he's done very well on the money-making front and the media empire front, and we'd just like to help him out in terms of covering really important news. You know, so he hasn't thanked us yet, but we're trying to do him a favor. And we're like, well, what would it be like if he treated a global climate disaster as the emergency that it really is? So, you know, our main point was not to pull a prank on him individually, actually, but it was a way to create a moment for people, as you say, in the subway, walking around in the morning. They get this free paper offered to them from a friendly person out there on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they start to read it, probably fairly quickly or eventually, they realize, okay, I don't know if this is real. It looks real, but I don't think the New York Post has acknowledged climate change too much, you know. And every article in there is fact-checkable. It's very rigorous science. Some of it's whimsical, some of it's funny, but it's all, you know, can be backed up by fact there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the climate change problem that we really do have, according to all the reputable scientists, pretty much, and even the Pentagon as saying that climate change is real and it's a problem and it's a national security problem. So we put all sorts of facts like that in there. I was a writer-editor on the project, and that was our basic goal, is the, hey, the UN Climate Change Summit is right here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And so we basically gave it out on Monday. The summit was starting the next day, and we wanted to show everyone what the New York Post would look like if the New York Post was saying, hey, the Big Apple is in big trouble because of climate change, and we need to protect our city and our families and our security and our safety by doing the right thing about climate change, because it's not a laughing matter. As much, there's a lot of humor in the paper, but it's not that
yeah.
The real situation is pretty grim.
Now, I will note that Rupert Keith Murdoch is one of the few people who claims American citizenship. He got it through an act of Congress, who also carries the title of Sir, which he picked up for publishing all those topless babes in the Sun in England.
Right.
So I understand that Sir Rupert the American actually was hand-delivered a copy of your version of the Post on Monday.
That is correct, and I was sort of the coordinator for our Grand Central Station area of the people giving out the Post. And a couple of guys came up to me and said, we just gave one to Murdoch, personally, like handed it to him through his bodyguards. And I was like, okay, these guys seem nice, but I don't know. And somebody else then confirmed that that had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I'm pretty impressed, guys, I got to say. And they said, yeah, we're going to go back here. Give us a couple more stacks. We'll keep giving them out outside his building. I said, you guys are pretty great. So what ended up happening, interestingly enough, is the New York Police Department was called to interrogate these guys, and they were detained in the news building.
Mm-hmm.
And the police took their papers, so we lost a couple hundred of these zillion papers we printed, but they were asked questions about who they were working for, what was going on, and they just basically answered honestly and were let go, because they really wasn't clear that they were breaking any laws, and so it all went by okay. But I did find that interesting, that the mm-hmm. the reaction was to try to shut it down a little bit near Murdoch's office.
And is
everywhere
any
else, we had no problem. I do want to say we had no problem pretty much elsewhere.
Now, Larry, does any of this skirt up against the law? Is it illegal to publish a newspaper that is the spitting image of an existing publication?
Well, it's a great question. You know, we did think about this a lot. We've done, you know, the guys did this fake New York Times, which I worked on a little bit, and
mm-hmm.
then with Greenpeace, some of us, including myself, worked pretty hard on a fake International Herald Tribune, which
right.
is fine. And then we did this one. The basic deal, again, I'm no lawyer, but we weren't selling it. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
It's a one-off. It's not like we're going to make a habit of this.
Right.
And it was pretty clearly fair use in terms of using parody,
mm-hmm.
you know, to make a point.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know how someone might react. But pretty much, I think we were pretty much within the law, according to the lawyers. And it's just one of those things. Someone can always try to sue.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, then we would get much more attention than I think they think we deserve.
Right, yeah.
So that kind of thing. Saul Alinsky, the great community organizer,
mm-hmm.
Said a long time ago, hey, you know what? The action is in the reaction.
Yeah.
So if your reaction is huge, it makes your action, quote unquote, more important. So I think a lot of times with this kind of thing, when people realize we're not making money off of them, you know what I mean? We're not stealing their business.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll benefit if they overreact to it. Yeah, just they'll just let it happen. I mean, in fact, the New York Post the next day acknowledged it in a little article where they said, well, these guys aren't really that funny, you know, but okay, we'll take the compliment.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so,
at least they tried to parody. I think they said something like they tried to parody a newspaper that people actually like. So they handled it quite well.
They,
you know,
spin
with
it.
Good humor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got to give them credit.
Now, Larry, how much preparation went into this? I don't imagine that just a couple of weekends ago you went into that underground wine cellar bunker there at UC Davis and had a, you know, a barrel or two of Merlot as you crank this stuff out. You must have.
It wasn't like pulling an all-nighter. If any of my students ever listened to this, this was not an all-nighter. Okay, just pulling it off. Guys, you got to work hard ahead of time, get your schedule going.
So how long did you
stop being a professor now?
How long did you work on this?
We did. It was months in the making. You know,
uh-huh.
As were the other ones. It was a faster schedule. I feel like people are getting faster and better at it. I was one of the sort of lead writer editors through, mm-hmm. in the process. So it's a wonderful sort of process where we get folks to submit ideas. Maybe we don't always use them, but still you get a lot of people just throwing items, and then you see how it all fits into the overall theme. And as a collective, we kind of make it work. And so this was a few months in the making, this one. Mm-hmm. The only frustrating thing about working on something like this is you really want to tell everyone. Because you're having fun.
Sure.
You're having this kind of devilish fun working on it. And you just have to kind of keep it under your, you know, keep it under your hat until it's time.
Well, it's good training for when you flip to become a double agent.
Well, exactly. I mean, you got to cash in at some point. You know, I think they have a better pensions on the other side, I'm told. So I got to think about that.
So do the yes men have a trust fund somewhere? Is there a sugar daddy? Because, you know, this is not a cheap project to publish.
Right.
How many copies of the Post? It was, what, a few thousand, 10,000?
Well, let's see. This is the radio. I'll tell you, the cover story is 2 million.
Uh-huh.
So we tell people, everybody out there, that we printed 2 million. But I will tell you, it was less than that.
Okay.
Peter, on your show, breaking news. But it was a lot. It was like a couple hundred thousand. It was a lot of papers.
Now, we know
and,
from newspapers.
I don't want to make trouble for saying that. But still, yes, there is a price tag to these projects. And I guess guiding principles. In fact, I was just giving a talk at Carnegie Mellon University about this stuff, and somebody asked me the same question. You know, where's the money come from? The answer is you do it as low budget as you possibly can. People work for very little or for, you know, volunteer a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you just try to make it as cheaply as possible. But you do get donations from good-thinking Americans and, you know, right, you know, open-hearted folks who see the value in this, and they say, look, I'll contribute to the price of making this. At least people should break even or something, you know.
And was the printing donated?
I don't think it was. I wasn't on that side of it, to be
uh-huh.
honest.
Because that's a big ticket item there.
Yeah, I think, in fact, that's the biggest item. For all of these, that's like the biggest
mm-hmm.
item, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, in fact, anecdotally, with the first one, the New York Times, there were a couple of printers who turned down the project because they were kind of scared
mm-hmm.
of it. You know what I mean? Which I understand.
Well, I've signed that disclaimer at Kinko's, so I understand.
There you go. Exactly. You know. So yeah, you know, but the money, especially with the Yes Men getting a sort of respect for the kind of work that they do, you know, they get people to donate a little bit of money here and there just for the expenses of their projects, which
mm-hmm.
I think is wonderful.
Now, I want people to know that you can go to the web and read this phony edition of the New York Post. You go to nypost-se.com. What's that SE stand for? Do you know?
Special edition.
Ah, I see. nypost-se.com. And that's the website Rupert doesn't want you to go to.
So please check it out.
And Larry, I hope you will snag a copy and bring it west when you return, because I'd like to put it up on my corkboard next to this actual edition of the New York Post I have, which incorrectly states that John Kerry selected Dick Gephardt to be his vice president. And it was a cover story. From what I understand, Murdoch himself phoned it into the newsroom and insisted that they go with it, even though the very next day he announced that it wasn't
right.
Dick Gephardt.
Well, fantastic. I think those two things should go next to each other. It's sort of like just showing that there's another way to work.
Mm-hmm.
You can get better results our way, perhaps.
Now,
I hope.
Now, before we move on to Pittsburgh, and I want to hear what's going on there, my friend Reverend Billy is the mm-hmm. Green Party candidate for mayor of New York. And Mike Bloomberg is going for an unprecedented third term. He claims he won't be mayor for life. Just one more chance, one more bite at the Big Apple.
Right.
And because he spends $80 million every time he runs for office, people kind of say, well, it's a stimulus package.
exactly. It sure is.
But I've known...
It's amazing. It's self-financing. I think Billy... I actually was interviewing Billy about it a little while ago, him and Savitri D, his
uh-huh.
awesome partner in crime there.
Yeah.
And they... I think Billy had broken it down at one point that... Bloomy was spending, I think, $300,000 a day on his campaign, at least recently. And it is staggering. And Reverend Billy rightly asks the question, what does that do to our democracy?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fair question.
Yeah.
It's parenthetically, especially since the Supreme Court now is deciding whether or not to remove all limits on corporate spending on elections, but that's a whole other alarming story.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the New York election, I think it's great that Billy is running what I would only call electoral guerrilla theater. I think they're doing a great campaign with the resources they have. They're keeping it very grassroots. Bill and Savitri are great performance artists and activists, and you know they're very funny and they're very sincere. And I think this is great. They have this great mix of like those sermons, you know, that he gives of, mm-hmm. against consumerism and
right.
And the monoculture.
Back away from that corporate coffee. Back away.
That's right. And he admits we're all sinners.
Yeah.
We all do it sometimes. So you know, and I'm like, that's great. And
but Larry,
it's a real serious point in the middle of the incredible hairdo and everything.
Well, I want to use Reverend Billy because my listeners know him quite well. He's a frequent
Great.
Guest here because I think he's a fascinating case study in the move from political theater to a kind of bizarre third-way zone.
Yeah.
Because last Christmas, when there was a Walmart greeter or security guard was trampled to death, by bargain hunters who were queued up before the store opened for some holiday bargains. And it was interesting because Billy was on CNN. I think he was on Fox. I think he was also on MSNBC. But they brought him in as the character, yet he gave commentary that was very sincere and grounded in his anti-consumerism message. And I thought that was a point where he crossed over, where this character went from something that is just an amusing concoction that you know blends theater and satire to a character, a persona, who was being regarded by the corporate media as somebody who had something to say about
right.
this trampling at a Walmart. And so I think that was a pivotal moment for him, where he really did cross over, and I think it's one of the things that encouraged him to run this campaign for mayor of New York. He doesn't expect to win, but more than, say, Jello Biafra running against Dianne Feinstein in the 80s
right.
here in San Francisco,
right.
He has the traction and he has some visibility that will actually allow him to make serious points against Bloomberg.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, there's also a little event that happened that sort of helps an anti-consumerist itinerant preacher, which is, of course, the big economic collapse, right,
mm-hmm.
the financial collapse.
Yeah.
So just, you know, there he was, and there him and Savitri and the Church of Stop Shopping were, you know, telling everyone that this is not sustainable. And sure enough, we have this unbelievable crash caused by deregulation, corruption, speculation, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this guy, it's almost like his time has come. Here he is. And they actually changed the name of the church from the Church of Stop Shopping to the Church of Life After Shopping.
Yeah.
Which is this wonderful, I think it's actually a great name. It's sort of like, okay, folks, you can't do as much shopping anymore anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? There is, it's not just a negative name for the church now. It's like, hey, there is life after shopping. Well, let's figure out what it is together.
Yeah.
And there he is. And they certainly do have things to say. And they're doing their whistle-stop subway tours where there you are in the morning if one of us weirdos hasn't given you a fake New York Post just to keep New York interesting. Instead, the doors open and in comes Reverend Billy and the Church of Life After Shopping doing a quick, you know, 45-second sermon and song,
mm-hmm.
and telling you about him running for office and the issues, and then off they go to
yeah.
the next car in the subway at the next stop. And it's a wonderful thing that they do every once in a while in New York, just trying to reach people for $2.25.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah. So, Larry, you're in Pittsburgh, and it used to be the G8. I don't know how it got to 20. Is that inflation?
Inflation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either that or lower standards.
Yeah.
But this is one of those economic summits where the plutocrats come to kind of, you know, say a few nice things so that they can continue plundering as usual.
Mm-hmm.
So what message do you want to deliver to those assembled in Pittsburgh, and what kind of vehicles are being used?
Well, you know, I personally am very grateful. In my case, like Carnegie Mellon University, their Center for Arts and the Arts and Society is bringing me in as, are you ready for this? A distinguished lecturer in performance and politics.
Oh, my God.
They are way too kind. But it's like, so that's there. They brought me in. I just gave a talk earlier today just tracing out the kind of protests that people have tried to do at the G8 or the G20 or what have you in the past. And I just tried to sort of give a pregame analysis of the situation that's about to unfold tomorrow and the next day here.
Mm-hmm.
The way I see it, there's two kinds of there's two forms of protest. There's a lot more than this, but I'm just saying there's proactive and there's reactive sort of campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
When the G20 comes to town, There's something great about going to protest there because, hey, all the cameras of the world are aimed at it. So you can sort of, like, jump in front of that camera a little bit with your protest, right? So it's hard to get the camera to turn to face you otherwise, so go where the cameras are aiming. And I see that logic. On the other hand, the part of it that makes me think it's kind of reactive and a little bit limited, not that you shouldn't do it, is just that they know you're coming. You know, it's their time and place. They have their strategic game, and you know, they can shut down the whole town. They've got all the forces of authority there. So it becomes important to have a presence there and to make your message against, say, globalization or the various wars that are happening, et cetera, or certainly the climate disaster we're facing. It's important to, I think, have a presence, but I think it's also important not just to be reactive in this way, but to be proactive, to create our own events outside of the G20, WTO, et cetera, kind of events, and go to places of our own time and choosing, and make events of our own that are interesting to people. So I'll give you a quick example, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
A group I admire very much, Iraq Veterans Against the War, they'll go to this kind of protest. In fact, they're going to be here in Pittsburgh during this event here at the G20. But they've also done their own, but maybe some of your listeners have seen them or seen them on YouTube. They'll patrol the cities of America using their training from their patrolling in the cities of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have their guns or even fake guns, but they're wearing their full battle gear and they're doing their training. And it's pretty disturbing mm-hmm. as you see what that's like. You can get a sense of what they've been through and also what it's like to be patrolled and occupied, if you know what I mean. So
sure.
That to me is a very proactive action because you don't know what's coming. The authorities don't know what's coming. It's very creative. It's very nonviolent, actually. It's
mm-hmm.
It's peaceful, but it's surprising and it's effective emotionally.
Yeah.
So I think we need to do both. I need to, as a social movement, we need to change it up. You know, go to the G20, come to Pittsburgh, bang your head against that wall a little bit, you know, because they are shutting down the town, basically.
Now, I'm looking at your website, and it appears that you're going to abandon your distinguished lecturer mode and impersonate an FBI agent, Christian White.
Special Agent Christian White, yeah, my buddy. We're going to be hanging out together. That's
uh-huh.
true. Yeah, I'm going to be doing after having done this talk and doing some fun stuff in the streets with friends the next couple of days. Going to be doing a show at 9:30 on Saturday, 9:30 p.m. At a place called the Waffle Shop. Again, thanks to Carnegie Mellon, and it's a piece that's about sort of state surveillance. It's a satire,
mm-hmm.
And I do take on this persona, but it's a piece that's about the sort of history of state surveillance of activists. And we all know that's happened quite a bit. And I'm going to get into some historical documents with a little slideshow. And it's a public service announcement sort of thing from Special Agent Chris.
And will Special Agent White be celebrating that the Obama Justice Department wants to extend some of the worst elements of the Patriot Act, like the national security letters for libraries?
Well, let's just say it's a nice sigh of relief.
Mm-hmm.
Makes the job a little easier. Yeah, what can I say? There are some disappointing developments have happened since the exciting days of November, but I think we all knew there'd be some disappointments. But yeah, that is definitely sort of the idea of the show is I look at the kind of activities that the FBI was involved in the 50s and 60s and 70s
mm-hmm.
with the sort of message of, hey, who's watching the watchmen? You know.
Well,
they had to ask in Rome, and we have to ask it now.
Well, I think that COINTELPRO, the Hoover program of the 60s and 70s, was exposed, and we believe it was terminated. But what we've seen in recent years is many of the same tactics have been used, particularly where they have infiltrated these alleged terrorist cells in the United States with a paid informant who typically has a criminal record. And that informant orchestrates, and provokes criminal activity by people who didn't have a clue about
right.
how to do it or, you know, what they were. There's this group in Miami that has been to trial twice now, and they can't manage to convict these people because juries don't buy it. And these people were, again, orchestrated by their paid FBI informant. They took a loyalty oath to Osama bin Laden, which, you know, none of them had ever thought of.
Right.
They talked about needing uniforms, and last time I checked, Al-Qaeda doesn't have any uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to blow up the Sears Tower, only none of them had ever been to Chicago and didn't even know where the damn thing is.
Right.
So
right. when it's purely, it's a little bit difficult. And, you know, it's a touchy subject. People are understandably afraid, you know, and I think we can all understand that. But you do have to ask, is this crime scenario being created, you know what I mean, by the agents? And that's a relevant question. And I want to have faith, you know, the American people are a freedom-loving people, I want to say. And this kind of activity goes against that, right? Mm-hmm. So I understand that they want to protect us, et cetera. But when you see this kind of activity, it's like, well, would this ever have happened? Would it have ever, is this being created by the agents themselves? And that's a serious line to cross.
Yeah. Larry, I wanted to ask you something because during the Bush years, on almost a weekly basis, I would receive a new satirical song about Bush, about Cheney, about the war, about the Constitution. I mean, it was a cottage industry, and, you know, there were some great tunes and satirical messages that were created there. And I've noticed a kind of, what's the right word, a break in the action, a real dearth of new material. And I wanted to know if you believe that the left has been kind of pacified by the election of Obama and is more patient about the war in Iraq, about escalating in Afghanistan, about continuing to hold people without charge and with on an unlimited basis at Bagram in Afghanistan, even as we say we're closing Guantanamo. And I'm just curious if you feel that people on the left are pulling punches or you know, kind of relaxing because they think that they worked hard enough to elect these people and they're going to fix it. What's your sense of where the public is in relation to the Obama administration?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And that's always the danger of an election, isn't it? It's like, you know, the election is a really important event. That's where you start. You know, that's where the work starts. But you may have been so exhausted from the campaign that you can't follow through as well. And I really do believe it's like, okay, Obama won. Now the work begins. There's this famous quote, often paraphrased by FDR. Okay, he won.
Mm-hmm.
Depth of the Depression, all these progressives come up to him and say, okay, we need Social Security. We need a jobs program. You know, we need all these different things. And he was like, okay, you've convinced me. Now go out there and make me do it.
Well, I've heard that.
FDR was no dummy. He said, I need you to build strong social movements and create pressure both on me and against the people who are pushing me in the other direction. Right?
But let me take that and use it as an example, because that was widely circulated in the first quarter of this year.
Mm.
But at the same time Obama was saying, make me do it, he was saying, but not single payer. In fact, Mr. Conyers, please don't even come to the White House. It'll only embarrass you. And so, you know, my feeling is that they've tried to push activism into certain channels. For example, the Obama website that was up during the first couple of months of the administration was taking policy suggestions from average citizens. Well, the number one item on the minds of American citizens is to legalize marijuana. And the Obama administration isn't interested in that. And they just said, never mind. Well, you know, when you invite activism and say, make me do it, and then say, but not that.
Right.
No, that's a real mixed message.
I mean, there's really, like, if your concern is to reach out to the quote-unquote other side of the aisle exhaustively, then you're disarming your own, that sort of grassroots energy, exactly of the kind you describe, where people say, oh, this is my issue, and it's deeply important to me. And you say, well, I know you guys helped get elected, but I'm going to try to reach across the aisle. I think what they're finding now in the Obama administration, if I'm not too hopeful, with the healthcare debate, is I think they're realizing, oh, wow, we really lost a lot of time trying to do that, and the other side is not interested.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be that this healthcare issue, I don't know which way it'll swing in the end, but that may be the issue that ended this attempt to thread the needle through the middle. And who knows? I think people are getting a little more active on this healthcare issue. I was just part of a demo in Manhattan where we brought out the billionaires for wealth care, which is the sort of sequel to billionaires for Bush. And it was a pretty good, strong turnout. And I think things might be turning on that front. But, you know, it's not going to happen without people getting reinvigorated on the left.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to believe that they're just going to be listened to. And I think you're right. This is a dilemma at this point.
Now, Larry, one of the things that activists look for is the magnifying effect of a small group of people taking action that gets blown up in the media or in the perceptions of those who are receiving the message. And one of the things I'd like to ask you about as we wrap up here is, how do you rate the other side? How do you rate the teabaggers and the Glenn Beck September 12thers and the birthers and the people who have, I have to begrudgingly admit, changed the agenda, thrown Obama off his initiatives, and really changed the framing and language of this to talk about death panels that don't exist, to talk about a birth certificate that's not in question. But they are succeeding as small groups of people with corporate money and organization. I don't want to, you know, skip over that.
Oh, absolutely.
But a true minority has been able to really turn the tables on a very skilled communications team at the White House. And you know, at least on an inning-by-inning basis, they've won the last three.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of factors at work here with the timing of it, and they may, you know, if they do win on this healthcare front with these techniques, it's it'll be one for the history books, along with the Swift Boat character assassination campaign against Kerry. You know, I think that by the way, you mentioned the death panels, the billionaires for wealth care. One of our main slogans is our death panels turn a profit. And we're trying to make the point death panels do exist right now. They're turning down life saving treatment all the time.
I call them. I call them death squads.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. But to answer your point, which is certainly something a lot of my friends have been asking about, one of the questions, what we're going to have to see how it plays out is, first of all, the other side, because they have succeeded, especially fueled, as you point out, with great corporate support, et cetera. They have done a lot of damage with an almost incoherent message, right, in a lot of ways. But nevertheless, there they are disrupting things. I think that for us, the question is, what's the counterpunch? We're kind of searching for the symbolic, creative, nonviolent, performative counterpunch. We have a few things are going on, billionaires for wealthcare on one hand. I also did a more, that's the ironic, satirical counterpunch. I also worked with some wonderful friends in the Bay Area recently. We did a more sincere move, which was to simply dress, it's almost like a 60s kind of very sincere style. We haunted the deathers at a healthcare thing event as real people with the real stories of real people who have been killed by corporate healthcare.
Yeah, but you were at a Pete Stark town meeting. Yeah. He's the only atheist in the House. Obviously the devil was working there.
That's it. And yet the spirits of the dead came to support him. So, you know, he may not believe in us, but we believe in him. There you go.
Yeah.
But I think that's the point, is we have to, like, not just we should bitterly complain about the fact that they're getting away with these things, but we got to make a counterpunch. We got to work our own campaigns that defuse their work. And then a question which I don't know the answer. I want to have an optimistic answer, but I would ask the same question of a campaign I was doing. So then I look at their campaign and I ask this question. With everything they're doing with, like, Obama with the Hitler mustache and as the Joker and all these strain and things that are easily disproven that they're claiming, does it only agitate their base and then a few other people? Does it turn off people that are sort of in the middle? And I don't know yet. I think that there's enough people in this country who don't identify as progressives or liberals or Democrats or anything. They're sort of right there in the middle, and they're losing their job or their house or what have you. If there's hope for us on this front, it's those people will look at the deathers and the birthers and the teabaggers and go, okay, those guys are not helping me, you know, and that their messaging will actually turn off enough people that are not already on their side.
But Larry,
we critique ourselves as we say, we don't want to just preach to our own side. And that's my question for them. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know yet.
Well, and Larry, I'm afraid that we learned under Bush that fear is electrifying, and it you know, like fleas, it jumps from one to the other and multiplies. And the politics of fear will always, I think, unfortunately, trump the politics of rational thinking. And that's one of the problems, I think, that the Obama team, they think they can deflect this stuff. They think they can just toss Van Jones under the bus and give his scalp to Glenn Beck, and that'll pacify him. But it only encourages them to do more. And I believe they have to stand and confront this. It cannot just be tossed off or shrugged off because they're scoring points with people who now cannot be reached with rational messages.
Right. And then, frankly, if when Obama responds strongly I think it gains respect, at least from some folks who haven't decided yet. So when he gave a speech, he said, you know, these claims about death panels, it's just a lie. It's dishonest. I think that was a strong, I mean, it's sort of straightforward, but I think to respond strongly, call people on what they're doing, and frankly, hit back in a certain way, you know, rhetorically. I think it's important to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if nothing else, it communicates that this is just as important to you as it is to them.
Okay, but in
the sense of urgency, you know.
In the speech where Obama did say death panels are a lie, he was called a liar by Joe Wilson over immigration, and that's what has stuck with Joe Wilson's base. And they're not listening to the rational arguments that Obama made in that speech. They're only listening to the attack, and that's all they need.
That's true. Now, what I'm hoping from that moment, in other words, is that Joe Wilson did his thing. Now, what I'm hoping is that there's these folks in the middle, you may call me optimistic, who saw that and just thought it was ugly and were turned off by it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know what? I don't know if that's true, but that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah. Well, Larry, I want to thank you for joining us. Keep
it's
up the theater. I got both thumbs up right now.
Thank you. Thanks. Likewise, Peter. I appreciate it.
All right. Good talking with you. Go to the website lmbogad.com. And you can get more information. Larry Bogad from the University of California at Davis. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
That's it for this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Go out and make some political theater of your own, please.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.